We're moving in this hour toward the Lord's Supper. It's fun to be able to have a passage in the Old Testament that is so blatantly about Jesus Christ. As I'm reading through some of the different commentators on this passage, there's some who are absolutely convinced that Jesus Christ is front and center of this passage. Amazingly, there's some who think he's not. And those are few and far between. But to miss Jesus Christ in the midst of this passage is to miss the whole point of this passage. So as we move toward this meal that we're called to partake of with Christ, because of Christ, we're at a section in this book that enables us to do that so very well. I trust that we'll get there together this morning. Daniel chapter 7. It's not a long passage, 28 verses, but I think it's worth reading before we jump into it this morning. Daniel chapter 7, beginning in verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions of his head as he lay in his bed. Then he wrote down the dream and told the sum of the matter. Daniel declared, "I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. Four great beasts came up out of the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. Then as I looked, its wings were plucked off. It was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. And the mind of a man was given to it. And behold, another beast, a second one, like a bear. It was raised up on one side, had 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth, and it was told, 'Arise, devour much flesh.' After this, I looked, and behold, another, like a leopard with 4 wings of a bird on its back. And the beast had 4 heads, and dominion was given to it. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a 4th beast, terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong. It had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces and stamped what was left with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another horn, a little one, before which 3 of the 1st horns were plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. As I looked, thrones were placed, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was white as snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was fiery flames. Its wheels were burning fire. A stream of fire issued and came out from before him. 1,000 thousands served him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court sat in judgment, and the books were opened. I looked then because of the sound of the great words that the horn was speaking. And as I looked, the beast was killed, and its body destroyed and given over to be burned with fire. As for the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, but their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven there came one like a son of man. And he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. As for me, Daniel, my spirit within me was anxious. The visions of my head alarmed me. I approached one of those who stood there and asked him the truth concerning all this. So he told me and made known to me the interpretation of the things. These 4 great beasts are 4 kings who shall arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, forever and ever. Then I desired to know the truth about the 4th beast, which was different from all the rest, exceedingly terrifying, with its teeth of iron and claws of bronze, and which devoured and broke in pieces and stamped what was left with its feet. And about the 10 horns that were on its head, and the other horn that came up, and before which 3 of them fell, the horn that had eyes, and a mouth that spoke great things, and that seemed greater than its companions. As I looked, this horn made war with the saints and prevailed over them. But he only prevailed over them until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was given for the saints of the Most High. And the time came when the saints possessed the kingdom. Thus he said, that is the one that he asked about the interpretation of this. As for the fourth beast, there shall be a fourth kingdom on earth which shall be different from all the kingdoms. It shall devour the whole earth and trample it down and break it to pieces. As for the ten horns, out of this kingdom 10 kings shall arise. And another shall arise after them. He shall be different from the former ones and shall put down 3 kings. He shall speak words against the Most High and shall wear out the saints of the Most High and shall think to change the times and the law. And they shall be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time. But the court shall sit in judgment and his dominion shall be taken away to be consumed and destroyed to the end. And the kingdom and the dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High. Their kingdom shall be an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey them. Here is the end of the matter. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts greatly alarmed me, and my color changed, but I kept the matter in my heart. When it comes to storytelling or story writing, there's some things that just make for a good story. One of the best introductions in all of storytelling history is this. It was a dark and stormy night, right? Yeah, that just sets things up great. As the book of Daniel reaches its climax here in chapter 7, or what has been referred to as the gravitational center of this book, or the theological heart of this book, this is basically the introduction that we're given in chapter 7. I want you to look at verse 2, Daniel chapter 7, verse 2. And Daniel declared, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, what? The four winds of heavens were stirring up the great sea. And so we have this dark and stormy night. Kind of a terrifying start. And that's the point. This is meant to be terrifying. Another aspect of good storytelling is scary beasts, right? And so Daniel, not to be outdone, says in verse 3, and four great beasts came up out of the sea. It was a dark and stormy night, and we have these great and terrible beasts. No story is complete then without the tension that's initiated by the villain, right? And so down in verse 21, we have this villain. As I looked, it says, this horn made war with the saints and prevailed over them. This horn, which is actually something or someone that is making war with the saints. That's a problem. The holy ones are suffering at the hands of one who is unholy. And then any good story obviously has its hero. And so, in verses 13 and 14, there came in the clouds of heaven one like a son of man, and he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him, and to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom. And so we have this story that's laid out for us, but it's not laid out like the other stories that we've confronted here in the book of Daniel. We've seen Daniel carried off to captivity, and he's been confronted with whether or not he should eat from the king's table. We're given the story of a king having a dream and nobody able to interpret it, so they're all going to die. But Daniel's brought in, he interprets the dream, and he's raised to glory. We're given the story of, after that dream, the king building this large, immense statue and gathering all his peoples to bow before them, and if they don't, they're thrown into a fiery furnace. 3 men refuse because of their obedience and their allegiance to their God. He throws them into the furnace, and God proves more powerful than the king. In chapter 4, we come to the king having another dream, and we see that he's been brought low. This tree is felled, and Daniel warns him, change your ways, acknowledge that there's a God in heaven who's superior to the king.
And King Nebuchadnezzar refuses. And so he's brought low, made to eat grass like an animal until he realizes that there's one in heaven who's bigger than the king. And he is King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And his dominion is an everlasting dominion. Chapter 5, we're told the story of a king who thinks himself bigger than the gods, takes the vessels of the temple and drinks, and heralds and praises his gods of silver, gold, bronze, and stone. Then the writing comes on the wall, and Daniel's brought in to interpret it, and we find this king dead before the chapter is finished. Chapter 6, we have those who are working against Daniel trying to bring together his demise as he's promoted within the kingdom.
We find a king who makes a law that afterwards he wished he hadn't made. And he's a king who's unable to exercise dominion in his own province, in his own domain. He's tricked and he's caught with his own words and his own pen. But there's a God in heaven who overrides the decree of the king, and he sets free the one who belongs to him. These are stories, right? And we can track the narrative flow of these stories. But when we come to this story, we find something that's so very strange. Here in chapter 7, we shift from narrative to apocalyptic literature. Apocalyptic. I like how Dale Ralph Davis introduces this section. He says, "We're now walking into the apocalyptic section of Daniel. It seems so baffling that some readers simply drop out. But I would argue from my own experience that such a reaction is completely unreasonable." And here I speak, he says, to the men in our congregation. If before marriage you imagine that you've begun to understand the female, you're incredibly naive. If after marriage you think you can divine the female, you are clearly deluded. If after years of happily married life you dream that at last you can fathom the female persona, you are utterly hopeless. And yet, none of that kept you from marriage, right? Neither should the mysteries of Daniel 7 through 12 keep you from plowing on through this book. As a pastor, when I looked at the book of Daniel, I thought, oh, this will be fun. Oh, this will be terrible. We'll have fun through the first six chapters, and then maybe we should just ditch it. We can't do that, because these are God's words. This is God's plan. This is God's program, and I wouldn't be doing you any favors if I didn't give to you the whole counsel of God. So we're going to plow on through this together, though it does contain mysteries. And we're not going to be able to solve all of them, I guarantee. But with humility and grace, hopefully we can understand and be encouraged and edified through this book together. Literally, the Greek word apocalypse means an unveiling. It's actually a Greek word. It means the unveiling, or that which is revealed. As such, it's understood to have implicit connections to the spiritual world. It's the idea of somebody within the spiritual world pulling back the curtain on that which is seen so that you can see that which is unseen. And so there are some of the features in this genre that we have to become familiar with. And Leland Ryken, a Christian literary professor, gives us these features of apocalyptic literature. First is this. It has a cosmic stage. The idea here is that as apocalyptic literature plays out, it plays out over the entire earth, including its sea, including the sky. So there's no place that's off limits as far as the staging for this drama that's played out in apocalyptic literature. The second is this. The forces of nature are brought in as characters within the story. Storms, winds, lightnings, hail, thunder, they become actors within the drama. A third is this. There's often otherworldly settings, usually heaven, that parallels or contrasts the actions that are taking place on planet Earth. And so we see behind the curtain that there's another world that's operative, and things are either paralleling or contrasting the events that are happening on planet Earth. A fourth characteristic is that there's supernatural agents in the cast of characters. Sometimes it's angels, sometimes it's demons, sometimes it's God. We also see that there's dualistic division between good and evil. and they're in conflict. And that's kind of the point of apocalyptic literature. Good you know to be good, there's no question. And evil you know to be evil, again, there's no question. And so you're meant not just to see it. In fact, you don't even have to make judgment on it. It's there. It presents itself as such. And you're meant more to feel it and respond to it than anything else. You're not making judgments on it. You're meant to enter into viscerally, to react to evil as evil, to respond to good as good. We see the events of apocalyptic presented in a kaleidoscopic format. It's like, you ever played with one of those little kaleidoscopes? Kids probably don't even know what a kaleidoscope is. Maybe there's a kaleidoscope app for your smartphone, right? Okay. You take this little thing, it has a hole in it, and it has a bunch of little colored stones or gems or something in the bottom, and you twist it. And as you hold it up to the light, there's a mirror in the middle that takes all these shapes, and it puts them together in a pattern. And as you twist, all these different shapes kind of fall into place, and you've got different patterns with every turn of your kaleidoscope. When we have a story, we have a narrative, there's a flow, and we can kind of trace it through a bell curve. We see the rising action, the climax, and then the fall and the resolution. But when we have apocalyptic literature, we have this little flash of this, and then we have a little flash of that, and all of a sudden we're in heaven, and all of a sudden we're on earth, and then we have a beast, and then we have a king, and so, wow, I don't get it. I'm confused. And that's part of the disorientation of apocalyptic literature that's on. We only see little snippets, but these snippets are put together in such a way that they're meant to create an effect. We also see that there's strange or fantastic animals, such as we have given right here. In the book of Revelation, we have these things that have the head of a woman with the hair of a woman, but they look like locusts. It's like, ooh, that's weird. You got this demon-breathing frogs. What in the world is that? Here we have lions with wings and dragons with ten horns. It's just strange, bizarre. This is another feature of apocalyptic literature. And again, the purpose is to see evil as evil and good as good, to see powerful as powerful, and not to render any judgment on it, just to feel that presence is the idea of apocalyptic literature. Animals often have symbolism, and so do numbers within apocalyptic literature. We're not going to spend a lot of time trying to discern numbers and the value of numbers and the symbolism of numbers. It's just not where we're going to spend a lot of time, especially today. We'll have to at some places because the numbers are really important. But numbers are often symbolic. Sometimes they're literal. Sometimes they're literary. We have to try to discern what's happening when it comes to numbers as they're used in apocalyptic literature. Often we have destruction that's cataclysmic. The idea is it's overwhelming. It takes over the universe. Or it would take over the universe if it weren't for the miraculous interventions within apocalyptic literature. What we find in apocalyptic literature is that it's specifically written to provide an impression. And the impression is an important part of the revelation. That is, we're meant to feel afraid because something frightful is coming down the pike. Something frightful is operative or entering into planet Earth, and you should be afraid. And so the pictures and the momentum and the kaleidoscopic jumble is meant to throw us off kilter in order to make us feel fearful about what's happening. But also, on the flip side, those who hold on to the revelation are meant to feel thrilled because something thrilling is in store for all who endure this coming threat and this perspective in the midst of their troubles. And so this apocalyptic literature is both dark and bright. It's both terrifying and hope-filling. And the purpose of it is to give hope. But the cumulative effect of the revelation is more important than the details. It's not that the details are unimportant, but the cumulative effect of this kaleidoscopic presentation is more important. The big picture is there's evil and there's good. Which will you choose? That's the point of apocalyptic literature. In fact, I think there's four things that will help us as we work through this study. Apocalyptic literature is understood to be divine revelation. That's purposefully impressive, but it's divine revelation. This is something that's given that you couldn't have come to on your own. It's given by God. It's a divine revelation that provides for us a big picture. It gives us a perspective, and that perspective is on world conflict. It gives us a big picture of the conflict that is currently taking place in this world, and it forces us, or it calls us, but it really forces us to commit to one of only two destinies when this conflict finds resolution. You will either stand with the good or you will stand with the evil. That's the only option. And in apocalyptic literature, evil always falls. So you either stand with the good or you fall with the evil. Excuse me. This is the point. This is what's happening in apocalyptic literature. And again, the cumulative effect is more important than the details. If you miss this, you miss the point, because this is the point. God is revealing a big picture to show you that there's conflict in this world, and at the end of the day, you will either stand with good or fall with evil. That's the point. Okay? To bring this home to us, look at verses 17 and 18. He asks for an interpretation of this dream. Here's the whole point of this vision. These four great beasts are four kings who shall arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High will receive the kingdom, and the idea is their kingdom, and it's the saints who will possess the kingdom forever and ever and ever. That's the point. You will either stand with the saints or you will fall with the kings. The choice is yours. This is the conflict. That's the interpretation. Okay, pretty simple when you stop and you look at this. But as we look at this apocalyptic literature, what we have to see is that This is giving us a story. It's not written in story format, but it's giving us nothing less than a story. And the otherworldly genre of apocalypse is essential to this story. It's nothing less than the story of world history, and unlike what's presented in many histories, the history that's presented here is not one that's cyclical, a repetition of good or striving for good, and because you didn't reach that zenith of goodness, you die and are reincarnated, and your karma builds on that life, and so maybe you get a second chance until finally you get it right and you're brought into oneness with this world ethos. There's very many religions, and most in ancient Near East were cyclical. There's this conflict between good and evil, and there's a never-ending conflict between good and evil. But we see that this is presented not as a cyclical presentation of history, but as a progressive presentation of history. There's a goal in mind. There's a telos. There's an end. And the Christian worldview is not the only worldview that has a telos or an end or a movement to history. An evolution, if you will, of man toward greatness. But what we find in the Christian worldview, as it's presented, is that the man is not the key player toward the progress of history. Instead, man is the primary problem as history moves forward. And what happens is that nature itself evidences that man becomes less dignified through the ages. What once was golden in its effect becomes silver, becomes bronze, becomes iron, becomes clay. What was once the king of the beasts moves down to that which is consumed ravenously. to that which ultimately destroys and gratuitously breaks and crushes and stomps any order out of planet Earth. So this is the progress that's presented to us in this vision, and it's absolutely backward. You couldn't get there apart from God telling us this is the way the world works. As we move forward this morning, we're going to move rather quickly because we are moving to this. This is the point of what we're going to. But we've got to get here through the text. But what I want you to catch is this. Only God can resolve the world's conflict between good and evil. It doesn't seem like it's that big of a proposition, but this is huge. If we don't believe this, we're going to spin our tires endlessly and fruitlessly. Only God can solve the problem of good and evil in this world. As we look at chapter 7, we see that it's a part of something bigger, right? This is the Aramaic section of the book of Daniel. We have an introduction in chapter 1. Chapter 2, we're given this vision of kingdoms. The kingdoms that are gold, silver, bronze, iron, clay, right? So we've been given this vision in chapter 2, four world kingdoms. Chapter 3, there's conflict because those who belong to the kingdom of God are confronted by the kingdom of man. God wins, surprisingly, right? God then confronts the king, who humbles himself and turns to God, and God gives him a heart like a man. Across this page, chapter 5, we move to another king who confronts God and finds himself dead before the story is over. Chapter 6, we have again the kingdom of God in conflict with the people of God, or the kingdom of man in conflict with the people of God, and God again wins this conflict. These are all narratives. This is the Aramaic section, written in Aramaic so that the peoples of the world are the audience. When we come to chapter 7, still written in Aramaic, this is for everybody to listen into. But we have a shift. Here the story came to a king, a Gentile king as he's asleep at night, and Daniel gives the interpretation. When we come to chapter 7, Daniel is the one who's sleeping at night, and an angel has to give an interpretation. This isn't just for the world to hear. This becomes a changing point. This is for the people of God to be the audience. Though it's written in Aramaic, it's the last section to be written in Aramaic because this is God's plan for all peoples of all times, of all ages, but it's meant to encourage the people of God in particular. And as we watch, we see that this, from a man's perspective, looks like this great golden monument to the reigning of man and mankind as the king of the world. From God's perspective, they're presented as beasts and beastly. And so we have this theme right here in the middle where the king is reduced to a beast until he acknowledges that God is in control. God is on the throne. God gives sovereignty and dominion to whom he will. And then he's restored to his kingship. Okay. That's what's happening as we move toward this passage. There is a man who is worthy of the title King of the Universe. But that man's going to come from someplace other than this cosmic realm of planet Earth. Let's very quickly note what the text highlights. We're going to look at the text is broken down for us in two parts. Verses 1 through 14, we're given the vision. In verses 15 through 28, we're given the interpretation. The structure of the text revolves and moves around the vision presented in the text. So let's look how this vision plays out for us. In verses 1 through 3, what we see is that four beasts emerge from the sea. From there, we see that the first three beasts are introduced, and then the fourth beast is introduced. And he's introduced as something entirely different from the first three beasts. They're all different, but the fourth beast is different in a different way, if we can put it that way. As we move forward, we see then that verse 8, a little horn rises to speak great things. And the word speaking great things is the idea of boasting. He's boasting great things. He's just put down three other kings. He rises to the top and he boasts great things. Then in verses 9 and 10, we have the Ancient of Days. And the idea is one who is aged, white hair. One who's been on the throne for long eons of time. One who's been there from the beginning and he's watched kingdoms rise and kingdoms fall. He has a wisdom and a patience that comes only with the ancient. This is the one who then sets up his court, calls all people together, opens the books, and looks down on the world at what's happening. Again, we have this little horn speaking and boasting great things. And whereas in verse 8, the little horn rises to speak great things. What we're given then in the beginning of verse 11 is that heaven kind of has to look down to hear these great things that this little horn is speaking. The end of verse 11, we see that the fourth beast is destroyed. I mean, there's not a lot of fanfare. It says he's killed. His body's given over to the flames. It's done. The boasting is gone. We see in verse 12, the first three beasts are basically dismissed. Their dominion is removed. They remain for a little bit. They're not annihilated like the fourth beast. They're just swept off the scene. And then we see in verses 13 and 14 that a human figure emerges. He emerges to take dominion. He emerges to receive kingship. And he doesn't emerge from the chaos of the sea. He emerges from the clouds of heaven. This is the story that we're given. And we'll see that at the very center of this story is the Ancient of Days convening his court. Remember what the name Daniel means? God is my what? God is my judge. Folks, apocalyptic literature is all about Judgment Day. Because at the end of the day, God is your judge. God is the judge of good, and God is the judge of evil. And he will hand over the kingdom of this world to his son. Let's look very quickly at how this works, because there's going to be nine truths that are going to be highlighted for us that are going to help us orient us in this conflict between good and evil. There in verses 1 through 3, where the four beasts emerge from this troubled sea, we see that God is in control of the chaos of this world. He says, verse 2, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven, that is, the spirits, wind, spirit, ruach, has the idea of God being in control, of turning up the fan and ruffling the waters, stirring up the great sea. And so the sea is in chaos. The chaos of the sea is a place of disorder. The sea is pictured as the source of all evil, all that's in opposition to God. And there's monsters that are sourced here. Monsters not of the fairy tale variety, but monsters of the occult variety. These are zombies and werewolves and witches, if you will. These are not innocent monsters. This is the realm, he says in verse 17, that's said to be planet Earth. When he's asked about it, he says, these great beasts are four kings who arise out of the earth. So the sea and its chaos is the picture of the chaos that's alive and rampant on planet Earth. But the point is, the four winds of heaven are sweeping over these seas. God is at work in the midst of the chaos, or seeming chaos, of the world. That's important for us to get cemented in our minds at the beginning of this story. Number two, God is in control not just in the chaos of the world, but he's in control of the kingdoms of the world. And so we move forward in verse 4. The first beast is like a lion. It had eagle's wings. And as I looked, its wings were plucked off. This is a passive verb. The idea is they were plucked off by God. Next line. And it was lifted up by God to stand on its two feet like a man. and a mind of a man was given to it by God. Where did we see this? This is the Babylonian king, right? Did we see any Babylonian king whose pride was plucked and then who was stood up on his feet and given a mind like a man? Nebuchadnezzar, right? Nebuchadnezzar. This is exactly what's happening. And this is written during the Babylonian period. It's written in the first year of Belshazzar, who should have remembered these things, but doesn't, and refuses to humble himself as this one did. But we move forward in verse 5, and behold, another beast, a second one like a bear, raised up on one side. That is, part of this beast is higher than the other. Probably a picture of Medo-Persia, with the second kingdom, Persia, rising higher than the Median part of the kingdom. It was raised up on one side, and it had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth. And it was told, arise and devour much flesh. And the idea here is it was told by God, arise and devour much flesh. And there's three ribs in its mouth. This seems kind of gruesome. But we move from this stately eagle, lion, eagle. We move to this barbaric bear who's just, he's got food dripping out. He looks like a junior high boy at lunchtime, right? Stuff's dripping out his face. And he's eating the flesh of the kingdoms he's devoured. Three, probably the kingdom of Lydia, captured in 546 BC, Babylon in 539, and Egypt in 522. But all of this is being written before the Medo-Persian rise to power. This is still while Belshazzar's on the throne. Babylon is still the king of the world. So we're seeing something that's happened. God is saying, understand, I'm not just in control of the chaos, I'm in control of the kingdoms. Then we move to Greece. After this, verse 6, another, like a leopard or a panther, think something that's stealthy and fast. And now to his swiftness are added not just two wings, but four wings. This is an Apache helicopter leopard. Okay, this guy can move. And as we see this happening, we see this representing the king of Greece, represented in chapter 8 by a great goat who doesn't even touch the ground as he's running. He's fast. But look how he presents this one in verse 6. The beast has four heads, and dominion was given to it. Again, a passive verb, given to it by God, by God. Number one, you have to recognize that God alone is in control of the chaos of the world. Number two, God is in control of the kingdoms of this world. Number three, there is a kingdom that's coming that's unlike any others. In chapter 2, we're told of a kingdom that's gold, that's silver, that has this bronze. And then we're told of this iron kingdom that moves down towards its feet and it's mixed with clay, and we're not really told anything about it. Here we're told about three beasts. One's like a lion, like an eagle, like a bear, like a leopard. There's no like when we get down to verse 7. After this, I saw in the night visions, and behold, there's a fourth beast. And all of a sudden, it goes into explain why this one's so different. It's terrifying and dreadful. It's exceedingly strong. It doesn't just have teeth. It has teeth that are great and teeth that are iron. On purpose, God is tying this beast to that iron kingdom back in chapter 2. It devours and breaks in pieces and stamps what is left. And it alone of all the beasts has horns. Think of different animals that have horns. How many horns do they have? Two. This has 10. Okay. Horns are symbols of power. And this doesn't just have two horns. This has 10 horns. This is a monstrosity. This is a guy who's a bad dude, and he's made worse because of the power that he actually has. And he's able and rampant in disseminating his power. And he wants us to understand that this kingdom is different than other kingdoms. Number four, there's coming a king that is different from all other kings. There's a kingdom that's unlike any other kingdom, and there's a king that's unlike any other kingdom. The horns are explained as kings up in verse 24. We're not going to spend a lot of time in the last half of this chapter. We're going to get this explained to us in following chapters, okay? But these horns are explained as kings in verse 24. And we see that one horn stands out from the other. Verse 24, it says it's different. Verse 24. As for the 10 horns, out of this kingdom, 10 kings will rise. And not only is the kingdom different, but this one horn will be different from the former ones. In what ways will he be different? Well, he's going to put down 3 kings, and this is emphasized 3 different ways. He puts down the kings in verse 24. These kings are plucked up in verse 8. These kings fall before this king in verse 20. So somehow this king is going to be different from these kings. He's going to put down some. And then verse 25, he's going to speak words against God, the Most High. He's going to flagrantly stick his finger in the eye, his fist in the face of God, and he's going to rebel against God with a high hand, with an open fist. God, I'm not taking this from you. You're going to have to deal with me. This is amazing. Then in verse 25, he's going to wear out the saints of the Most High. What does that look like? Verse 21, this horn will make war with the saints, and he'll prevail against them. 2 things that mark this king, this horn. He's different. This king is different than all other kings because there's 2 focuses that he has. One on God and one on God's people. And these are the 2 things he's going to stand against. And in standing against, this is what he stands for. I'm against you because I'm for me. I'm against you, God, and I'm against your people. As he elevates himself to be worshipped as God is the idea through all these things. Then verse 25, he's going to change the times and the law, and this shall be given into his hand. Again, a passive verb. This will be given into his hand by God. Even this king doesn't extend his hand beyond the hand of God. We come to the Ancient of Days setting up his court, and we find that God is the judge of all kings and all kingdoms. It's interesting, the pace of the apocalyptic literature. It's not narrative, but as the story is unfolding, you're watching one beast, then another beast, then you're seeing this king and these horns, and then you're watching this horn come up. And all of a sudden, listen to verse 9, and you'll see it in the ESV here. It's listed or framed as poetry. As I looked, thrones were placed. Placed. They didn't rise up. They're not moving. This is on purpose. Somebody is taking, they're setting, they're putting things in order. The exact opposite of the sea. Something's happening now at the right place, at the right time, in the right order, at the right pace. The Ancient of Days comes and takes his seat. Don't you love how it says that? Just, he's in control. It gives a picture of him, white as snow, hair like wool. His throne is fiery flames, and its wheels are a burning fire. His throne is presented as a moving chariot. He can move this place of sovereignty wherever he wants, whenever he wants. He's over all, is the idea. And so here's this Ancient of Days who's over all kings, all kingdoms, and the pace is one of sovereignty. And we see that this little horn is prevailing. Why don't you go up to verse 22. As I looked, the horn made war with the saints, and it prevailed over them until the Ancient of Days came. This horn prevailed until judgment was given for the saints of the Most High. This horn prevailed until the time came when the saints possessed the kingdom. Here's the point. All of this is given by God. All of this authority, all of this power is given by God until God decides it's time to be done. Because God is the judge of all kings and all kingdoms. And so now we see that this world's greatest king poses no threat. The king takes his throne. He's seated. Verse 10, a stream of fire issues out from before him. Thousands and ten thousands are serving him. And as the books are opened, he looks down on the arrogant speaking horn. And what happens? He's dead. The whole thing is diminished. It's destroyed. It's brought to dust. And there's nothing that's left on it. And so the court sits in judgment. In verse 26, his dominion is taken away. In the end of verse 11, the beast is killed, his body is destroyed, and it's given over to be burned with fire. The king poses no threat. The kingdom retains no glory. In fact, the glory of the other kingdoms is transferred to the saints. It says the glory of their kingdoms, they retain their lives for a little while. They're not immediately incinerated directly by God, though their dominion is taken away. But look at what he says in verse 27. The kingdom and the dominion of the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven is given over to the saints of the Most High. And so we find at the very center of this whole story, verses 17 and 18, kings rise up from the earth, but the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever. Verse 25, he shall speak words against the Most High, he shall wear out the saints. Verse 26, but the court sits in judgment and his dominion is taken away. God says, you can do what you want to do, but only until I say otherwise. My friend, this isn't just about a little horn. It's not just about kings and kingdoms. This is about you and me having sovereignty in our own lives with a small s, having free will, being made in the image of God, as those who are given dominion over planet Earth. What will you do with God imaging gifts? Will you shake your fist in the face of God and say, I will be my own king? You can do that. But you can only do that for a while because God sits on the throne and he's the king and he's the judge. And he'll only give you enough leash to hang yourself. And so we come to the end of the story, and we find this human figure who emerges from the clouds of heaven. And when he does, the king of this world takes his rightful place. Look at verses 13 and 14 again, because this is the heart of the book of Daniel. Verse 13, and I saw in the night vision, and behold, with the clouds of heaven there came one like a son of man, and he came to the Ancient of Days, and he was presented before him. This is Revelation chapter 5, by the way, right? And to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, so that all peoples, nations, and languages, Babel, Genesis chapter 11, are brought together again under him and serve him. And the word serve has the idea of worship. This isn't just a man, this is God, a God-man. And his dominion is an everlasting dominion which will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will not be destroyed. Now all of this leaves Daniel chapter verse 15, verse 28. He's anxious. I mean, this is great, but this is scary. This is intimidating. This is terrible. There's one who's given power to wear out the saints and will chase them down and will prevail against them. And he says, I'm not just anxious, I'm sickened. The breath is taken out of me. He says, I'm alarmed by these dreams. So what do we do with this? What are our take-home points this morning? We've kind of rushed through this. But you've got what you need to go home and work through this again if you'd like. But don't miss these things this morning. The first is this. The rightful king of creation is a son of man. God rules, but he's given the rulership of this world to man. He's put all things under man's feet, a son of man. When the Son of Man takes his throne, the saints will be given the kingdom. One time, there in verse 14, we're told that the kingdom is given to the Son of Man. But, verse 18, the saints of the Most High receive the kingdom. Verse 23, judgment is given over for the saints of the Most High, and the time came when the saints possessed the kingdom. Verse 27, under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High the greatness of the kingdoms. Three times it emphasizes, if you're with the king, you get the king's kingdom. When the king gets the kingdom, he turns it over to his people. You get the kingdom with the king. It's an important thing to keep in mind. Number three, the enemy will seemingly prevail over this Son of Man. Interestingly, when Jesus is confronted by the Sanhedrin in Mark chapter 14, they say, tell us, are you the Christ? He says, I am. And one day you'll see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven to take his throne. And with that declaration of himself as the king of all history, the enemy turns the king's heart and nails the king of the universe to a throne. No, he nails him to a cross. He lifts him up between heaven and earth, where he stands as a high priest between God and man and God. And he gives up his life. And it looks like at this moment, when this flesh is torn and this blood is spilt, that the enemy wins. He prevails. But he doesn't. But the Son of Man enters into the conflict with weakness, with submission to the will of the one who is good and in control. And then we see that the worst that the enemy can do is to take hold of our flesh. He can't prevail against your spirit. He can prevail against your flesh. Number five, we see that the king's resurrection from the dead will bring life to all over whom the enemy prevails. We're not told about resurrection here, but we're told about resurrection here. Because the saints are the ones over whom the enemy prevailed, right? The beast prevails, but the saints still get the kingdom. How does that work? It works because we have a king who's resurrected from the dead and gives life to those who are killed by the beast. Number six. And this is the most important one. There is a conflict in this world, and you do not have the right to be neutral. You can think you do, but you don't. Because if you don't choose to side with Jesus and enter into the opposition of the enemy, then you are siding with the enemy. Jesus said, all who are not for me are against me. That's the only option, my friend. These are the take-home points that we have to get locked in our head. And this becomes the key to all human history. If this isn't your view of the world, then your view of the world is wrong. Because this has to define how you look at life. Because this is how God looks at it. Only God can resolve the conflict between good and evil. And this he does once and for all in the person of Jesus Christ, who dies and conquers death and gives life and the kingdom to all who would follow. Let's pray.